Hello, it's Debbie, back again on Wednesday, May 11th, 2016, with the Decatur Herald and Review E-Edition, reading off the screen, starting out with Memorabilia Brings Decatur Alumni Back to the Past. This is by Ryan Voiles, staff writer for the Herald and Review. Decatur. It's been nearly 60 years since Benny Benscotter first wanted to become a cheerleader. As a student at Decatur High School in the mid-1950s, Benscotter was denied the chance to become a cheerleader due to her father's concerns over her safety during travels. But on Tuesday afternoon at Stephen Decatur Middle School, the 57 graduate of Decatur High School finally got her school sweatshirt and pom-poms thanks to the discovery of more than 100 boxes of uniforms that paint the picture of Decatur education over the past 60 years. The content of those boxes, old uniforms, letter jackets and sweaters, cheerleaders' pom-poms, and school t-shirts were made available for sale to the public Tuesday as hundreds of past students, family members, and curious onlookers walked through the galleria of the school, which had more than 1,000 items laid out on dozens of tables. For those such as Benscotter, it was a chance to remember her high school days and what could have been. I got myself a few stuff. I think this couldn't be quite what she said. Anyway, I got myself a few stuff from Decatur High School, and I even got myself a button with a cheerleader's megaphone on it, she said with a laugh. The memorabilia discovered over the course of building renovations were from Mound and Roosevelt Middle Schools, both long since closed, Stephen Decatur High School, which is now a middle school, and Eisenhower and MacArthur High Schools. Within the first hour of the sale, more than 100 people had arrived at the school to look for items, said Zach Shields, executive director of Decatur Public Schools Foundation. Proceeds from the event will be divided between the student council and the foundation, but Shields said the monetary aspect was not a major driving force behind the event. We want to connect people back to their school days, and hopefully people will be really happy with what they find, Shields said. I've had a few people that randomly found their own jerseys from when they played. Among those lucky enough to stumble upon their own personal history was Margaret Bush. As a seventh grader at Stephen Decatur Middle School in 2001, Bush was part of the junior high basketball team. Although she can remember only two wins and not making a shot all season, Bush said the bond her teammates developed and the positive influence that stemmed from being a member. So when she found her old jersey among the items, a feeling of nostalgia came through. It was just a fun adventure looking for the history, kind of my bragging rights and finding the jersey like, it's mine, she said. Even those who were not involved in athletics could join in the fun, as Steve Trabash showed with his box of memories. A 76 graduate of MacArthur, Trabash said the items would make for great conversation starters as he goes around town or to auto shows. We got an older Mustang, so when we go to shows, we sit and talk with the other people there. Trabez said, we start comparing notes and realize we could have actually been in high school together. Some of the events said they were still deciding what to do with their purchases, whether to wear them in public or display them. As someone with a long connection with the Decatur schools, Pat Ryan had no hesitation with his future plans. A student and longtime teacher and coach in the Decatur School District, Ryan found a 42 numbered MacArthur Generals jersey similar to the one he'd worn as part of the 1965 team. After a wash, Ryan said he planned to fold the jersey, place it on display next to the one he wore in college. We all live in the past, I guess, with our Decatur sports, he said. End of that article. In crime and courts, Cunningham not guilty on weapons charges. This is by Huey Freeman, another staff writer. Decatur, after deliberating for about 45 minutes Tuesday afternoon, a jury of six men and six women found Demario Cunningham not guilty of possession of weapons by a felon. Cunningham, 35, was charged with possessing two loaded semi-automatic pistols after police officers were called to a house in the 1500 block of North Church Street to check on the welfare of an adolescent girl about 1:15 a.m., March 22, 2015. The evidence presented by the state at the two-day trial consisted of Cunningham's fingerprint on an ammunition magazine and the testimony of the Church Street resident in which he said the guns found in his closet belonged to Cunningham. In his closing argument, Assistant Macon County Public Defender David Ellison told the juries that a magazine is not a firearm. A firearm is capable of firing a projectile. A magazine is not, Ellison said. Ellison said the resident, a relative of Cunningham's whom Cunningham frequently visited, was trying to put the guns off on DeMario when the police arrived, although they really belonged to him. Ellison said the courtroom testimony of the resident was not consistent with what he told police when they arrived at his home. He told them where the guns were at, Ellison said. He told the police one thing and told you guys something else. Ellison said there was DNA found on the gun, but the resident's DNA was not compared to it. Cunningham's DNA was not found on the guns when tested by scientists at the Illinois State Police Forensic Science Laboratory. Cunningham did not testify during the trial. Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz said forensic scientists testified that sometimes DNA will be on guns, but not always. She said the resident testified that Cunningham was passing the guns back and forth with another man at Church Street House, which could have led to uncertain DNA results. It's normal to have a mixture, so much information you can't discern what it is, Kurtz said. When the first officer arrived at his house, the resident told him possible places he might find the guns, but he didn't say exactly where they could be found. He says, "Search my whole house," Kurt said. He has zero to hide. He wanted this defendant and his guns out of his house that night. He didn't want them there. She said the magazine with Cunningham's fingerprint on it fit inside the Ruger 45 caliber pistol that this defendant possessed. When the police came to the Church Street resident that morning, they found a girl younger than 15 who reported that Cunningham had sexual relationship with her for the past 5 months. That was apparently the primary reason the police were called to the house the morning of the firearms were found. Due to its potential prejudicial influence in the weapons possession trial, the jurors heard nothing about the ongoing case, which is pending in the Macon County Circuit Court. He is being held in jail without bond in that case, in which he's charged with 4 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. He is due in circuit court May 25th for a status hearing. A grand jury indictment alleges that Cunningham committed sex acts with the underage girl between October 4th, 2014 and March 21st, 2015. The girl told police that Cunningham gave her crack cocaine to smoke and that she had smoked crack in the residence with her a few hours before police arrived. Cunningham was released from prison September 4, 2014 after serving part of the sentences of 5 years and 18 months for convictions on manufacture, delivery of cocaine, and obstructing justice. In 2013, Cunningham was awaiting trial on first-degree murder charges for allegedly shooting to death 19-year-old Marvin Dickerson in the back with an AK-47 assault rifle on August 22, 2011 on North Union Street. Those charges were dismissed when Marvin E. Perry, 22, the only eyewitness to the Dickerson slaying, was shot to death in an unrelated incident on August 15, 2013. Joshua A. Jones, a parolee at the time of the incident, was sentenced to 12 years in prison for manslaughter for Perry's slaying. That's the end of that article. Next, education. School board debates Robertson Charter School renewal. This is by Valerie Wells, another staff writer. Decatur. The Decatur School Board spent a significant portion of its Tuesday meeting debating the proposed contract renewal with Robertson Charter School. The school's original 5-year contract in 2001 was renewed in 2011 and has been under negotiations since January. Because the district has new legal counsel and because charter schools are under increasing scrutiny, said Ted Kavolt, chief operations officer, several provisions in the proposed renewal were of concern. The administration needs guidance, he said. We want the language to be clear in the case of scrutiny. Among those concerns that were instructional and administration costs are both lumped under payroll in Robertson's financial records. The contract does not spell out academic goals and objectives in pre-kindergarten, which is paid for by a grant and is not recognized in the contract. Decatur administrators presented the contract to the board, which had previously been approved by Robertson's board, with a recommendation to reject the contract until these points had been cleared up as council recommended. Board member B.A. Butts objected to the motion to reject the contract and said that negotiations should have been completed before the administration presented the contract. "I'm taken aback with the recommendation to reject the negotiated proposal," he said. "I wish to make an amendment that we accept the proposal with the stipulation that the negotiations continue to show our support for Robertson Charter School." Dan Oakes said it would not be possible. Once the board approved the contract, negotiations would be at an end. There was also questions about whether Decatur officials had made regular compliance visits to Robertson, and Superintendent Lisa Taylor said that had not happened and that previous contracts were not well written. Charter contracts are not included under the Open Meetings Act as something that can be discussed in closed session, which is why the discussion was held in open session. In the end, the board approved the contract as presented, with President Sherry Perkins, Butts, and T.J. Jackson voting to approve, while Oakes and Fred Spanius voted against approval. Board members Brian Hodges and Alita Graham were absent. In other business, the board approved hiring James Gortner as new director of Buildings and Grounds, replacing retiring director Mike Sodaroff. Gortner has worked as Sodaroff's assistant for the last several months. Deanne Hillman, currently principal of Oak Grove School, was named Assistant Director of Human Resources, and Sarah Nupel was named the new principal of Pershing Early Learning Center. Knupel is currently principal of Durfee Magnet School. Tammy Wagers was hired as a Special Education Administrator. Two representatives of the Illinois Association of School Boards spoke to the board about the process to search for a new superintendent. Taylor is leaving in July to become principal in Hayworth. "Time is too short to do a proper search by then," said Larry Dirks, Field Services Director, "as good candidates already have contracts." Their recommendation was to hire an interim superintendent, possibly for the entire 16-17 school year, to allow enough time for a thorough search. "Anybody not signed to a contract by February, we don't want," said Oakes, who's been on the board through several searches. The board members agreed an interim is the direction they want to go, and spent a few minutes discussing the option of using an internal candidate's interim, though no decision was made. End of that article. Next, education again, statewide though. Senate okays Menar School funding bill. This is by Dan Petrella, the Springfield Bureau Chief for H&R. Springfield, the Illinois Senate approved a bill Tuesday aimed at overhauling the way the state distributes money to public schools to get more funding to poorer districts that need it the most. The legislation from State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat, Bunker Hill, which passed on a 31-21 vote, has become a focal point of debate as the General Assembly nears its scheduled May 31st adjournment. Democratic supporters say it would address the inequities in the current funding formula, considered one of the least equitable in the country. Meanwhile, Republicans, including Governor Bruce Rauner, have panned it as a bailout for Chicago public schools. Menar, who has been working on the issue since being elected to the Senate in 2012, called the funding formula change, quote, "one of the most profound anti-poverty measures we will take up in any number of years," unquote. And he continues to say, "this bill will attack poverty in the classroom, plain and simple," Menar said, noting that an average Illinoisan pays $2,400 less per year educating a low-income student than a wealthier one. Opponents criticized previous versions of his proposal for shifting money away from wealthier districts to funnel it to poorer ones. In response, Menar added language to the final version that would prevent any district from losing money in the first year. The so-called hold harmless provision would phase out over the following 3 years, resulting in some districts seeing a decline in state funding. The bill also includes another provision called adequacy grants that would prevent districts from losing money if they're taxing at or above the state average but aren't able to meet a benchmark for adequate spending. That would stay in place until 2024. Together, those provisions would cost roughly $442 million in the first year, according to Illinois State Board of Education projections. Under Menar's plan, the state would also begin picking up the tab for Chicago teachers' pensions, something it already does for the rest of the state. That would cost another $205 million. During debate on the Senate floor Tuesday, State Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican Bloomington, continued GOP's criticism of the bill as a bailout for Chicago schools. "No one disagrees that the formula that exists today is broken," Berrickman said, later adding, "This isn't the fix that millions of students around this entire state want and deserve." He said he's preparing to introduce legislation that would shift Illinois to an evidence-based school funding formula. "It's disappointing that Senator Menar wants to ram this through on a partisan vote," Berrickman said afterward. From Menar's point of view, what's disappointing is the lack of support for his plan from downstate Republicans, most of whom represent school districts that would stand to benefit from it. "Why are Republican members of the legislature voting against a bill that's in the best interest of their districts, particularly downstate members?" he said. "Here's the answer: 'cause Governor Rauner told them to." Rauner is pushing to fully fund schools under the current formula, which Menar and other Democrats argue would only perpetuate existing inequalities. This has led the governor to accuse Democrats of threatening to hold school funding hostage over passage of Menar's plan. The issue isn't merely a partisan one, however. House Democrats haven't lined up behind the Senate plan, and a panel convened by House Speaker Michael Manigan, Democrat, Chicago, to study the issue was holding a hearing at about the same time Menar's bill was being debated. Earlier Tuesday, several House Democrats, including State Representatives Pat Verschoor of Milan and Andy Skoog of LaSalle, held a news conference with school superintendents from the Quad Cities, Streeter, and elsewhere across the state to call for funding certainty for next year. "We need to determine exactly what we want in Illinois for education for our students in the public schools," Rock Ridge School Superintendent Jack Bambrick said, "and then we need to figure out how we're going to fund it adequately." End of that article. Continuing on with the A section, but here we are in local. Letter carriers hope to collect 100,000 pounds of food. This is by Teresa Churchill, a senior writer for H&R. Decatur. Mother's Day usually falls the day after Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive, but members of the Stephen Decatur Branch 317 of the National Letter Carriers Association are gearing up this week for their 24th annual event held on the second Saturday of May. "The calendar kind of threw everybody off, but we're still hoping to collect 100,000 pounds this year," said Betsy Coleman, the Decatur letter carrier who's in her sixth year coordinating the drive. To participate, postal patrons are asked to play fresh and unopened non-perishable food in bags besides their mailboxes as early as possible on Saturday. The union will then distribute it to 8 local food pantries. The lineup of pantries has changed slightly, however. Coleman said Hopeful Heart Ministries, a mobile food ministry of Oak Grove Parkway, Trinity, and Westside Churches of the Nazarene is taking the place of Decatur Catholic Churches. Decatur Catholic Charities, which asked to bow out and let a smaller food pantry benefit. "We're thrilled," said Gladys Bulblitz, treasurer of Hopeful Heart and a member of Trinity Church of the Nazarene. "We have not had help like this from an outside organization in the 8 or 9 years we've been running." Bulblitz said the ministry's Green School Bus distributes food to the needy twice a month on a rotating schedule from one of its 4 church parking lots. The other food pantries to benefit are Ambassadors for Christ, AMELCA, AMELCA, Antioch Missionary Baptist Church, Northeast Community Fund, New Vision, Reasonable Service, and the Salvation Army. The food drive's tally last year was a little less than 70,000. The total for the annual effort peaked at 120,000 in 2005 and has not reached that level since. The event comes at an opportune time for food pantries that feed more children during the summer while school is not in session and that are running out of the surplus of donations that come at Christmas time. Most requested foods include canned fruit, multigrain cereal, canned meats, peanut butter, beans, canned vegetables, rice, oatmeal, pasta, soup, and baby food. Pet food, paper products, and laundry detergent will also be accepted. No glass containers or expired foods will be taken. People also may also bring donations after 10 a.m. on the day of the food drive to one of the 3 staging areas, to Nelson Park, coordinated by letter carrier Laura Sturgeon, Fairview Park, coordinated by letter carrier Angie Miller, and the Letter Carriers Union Hall at 2955 North Woodward Street, coordinated by Coleman. Event co-sponsors include the Decatur Trades and Labor Assembly and Kroger. End of that article. Education. Dentist students rock a positive attitude. This is by Valerie Wiles again. Decatur. Dentist school students spent last week thanking in person some of the people and organizations that have been supportive of their projects. They handed out metal coins emblazoned with "You Rock," and on the back of these coins is a website where the recipients can log the date, the coin's serial number, and their location. "We're working with positivity and trying to make a positive impact on the community and the world," said Linnaeus Eilts, who is on the Public Relations and Social Media Committee. "There's all this negativity on social media. We wanted to start a positive social campaign so we can make the rocks and design them ourselves, and we're giving them out to everyone who has helped us and rocks." Students wrote their own grant to the Decatur Public School Foundation to pay for the project, said teacher Brittany Acree. They used the $1,200 to buy 250 of the coins. The hope is to raise enough additional money to sell coins in 5 packs to people who want to start their own project. They also designed the web page with assistance from local computer programmer Martyr Mavis, who has helped dentist students with other projects, said teacher Keith Creighton. First stop on Wednesday was Tabernacle Baptist Church and Pastor Chad Williams, who said he thought he could get his coin all the way to South Africa this summer. "That would be awesome," McCree said. The church allows dentist students to use its gym for basketball and volleyball games and practice, said Mackay Hayes, the eighth grader who presented Williams with his coin. The church also donated $4,000 to the school's Habitat for Humanity project to build a home in the West End. "We've been blessed to host their volleyball teams and basketball teams, and we're setting up other partnerships with them as well to be a blessing to the school," said Williams, whose children also attend Dennis. "We just want to love on the community that's around the church, and a great way to do this is to partner with the school." Tabernacle also has partnerships with Sangamon Valley East in Harristown and Meriden's Elementary School in Blue Mound, he said. From there, students went to the Secret Garden and presented a coin to the owners, Lori and Michael Barrett. They also have a student at Dennis, and Lori Barrett said she's created arrangements for various Dennis events and a silk arrangement to be auctioned off for the Habitat project. The students visited the Professional Development Institute, Decatur Public Library, Decatur Area Arts Council, Sloan's Calzones, Edward Jones, and Lock, Stock, and Barrel. The website for the project, officially the Rocking Ripple Effect of Positivity, is dennislablink.com/YouRock. End of that article. Next article, Crime in Courts by Huey Freeman, a staff writer for H&R. Testimony places Woodson in vicinity of shooting scene, Decatur. Before jurors began deliberating late Tuesday, the defense presented its case in which Arkie Woodson's mother and aunt said they were with him at the time of the shooting. The state presented a physician who said the 26-year-old male shooting victim only survived because the bullet was deflected by a rib. On the second day of the trial of Woodson, 17, for charges including Class X attempted first-degree murder and armed robbery, the state also presented forensic cell phone evidence, which placed his phone in the vicinity of the shooting, which occurred at 10:10, March 15, 2014, in a vehicle parked at Locust and Charles Street. If convicted of the main charges, as well as firearms enhancements, Woodson will be sentenced to between 62 years and life in prison. Woodson's mother testified her son was with her from 7 or 8 p.m. that night till 2 a.m. the following morning at her sister's house in the 900 block of North Wilder Avenue. Her sister testified she picked up Woodson and Woodson's mother that night and drove them to her house. Both women acknowledged that they first revealed this alibi to the defense attorney in August 2015. Almost 17 months after the incident. Neither told police their stories. Decatur Police Detective David Daly, a forensic mobile device analyst, testified there were 5 calls between the phone of Woodson and the victim between 9:55 and 10:07 that night of the shooting. Woodson's phone was disconnected 3 days later. Data provided by AT&T showed that Woodson's phone was in the vicinity of Charles and Locust between 10 and 10:09 on March 15th. The phone was not in the vicinity of the 900 block of North Wilder at that time. Dr. George Liu, a surgeon at Decatur Memorial Hospital testified the bullet entered the victim's body on his right side, struck his seventh rib from the highest, entered his chest cavity, and stopped a few millimeters from his heart. If it had not hit the rib, he would be dead, Luce said. Decatur Police Detective Adam Jarrus testified that when he interviewed the victim in the hospital on March 16, 2014, he presented him with an array of six photographs. He identified the photo of Woodson, circled it, and said he was 75% certain he was the shooter. He then showed Jarrus a Facebook photo someone gave him of Woodson. He said he was 100% sure it was that man. Jurors resumed their deliberation at 9 a.m. on Wednesday morning. That would be today, the 11th. In the courtroom of Circuit Judge Thomas E. Griffith. End of that note. And now to some local briefs for today. Police seize K2 drug. Police swarmed a collection of Decatur businesses and homes Tuesday at a major crackdown on the distribution and sale of K2, a form of synthetic marijuana with dangerous side effects. Officers from Decatur Police Department and the Macon County Sheriff's Office executed 10 search warrants and seized 10,000 packages of the drugs in cash. There was no word on arrest late Tuesday, but police said the operation was continuing. Decatur, Millikan Science Event. Millikan University will host the Illinois Junior Academy of Science State Exposition on Friday and Saturday, May 13th and 14th. Events will be held on campus and at the Decatur Indoor Sports Center. More than 1,200 students will exhibit research and design investigations. Pedestrian traffic will increase significantly during this event in the areas of Wood and Main and Oakland Avenue. Decatur, Rock Springs Bottling, a naturalist-guided hike to the historic early 20th century Rock Springs Bottling Plant will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 14th, starting at Rock Springs Nature Center. The free hike for ages 8 and older will be 3 miles round trip. Pre-register online by noon on Friday at the Macon County Conservation website. Moroa. School board vacancy. Moroa Forsyth's Board of Education is accepting letters of interest for a vacancy due to the recent resignation of board member Jill Appleby. Candidate must be at least 18, a resident of Moroa Township for a minimum of 1 year, and a registered voter. Submit letters to Mike Williams, the superintendent of schools, Box 738, Moroa, by Thursday the 26th. Education. Gifted students finding ways to make Decatur better. By Valerie Wells. Decatur, gifted middle students have plenty of ideas for making Decatur better. First, they met in a large group to talk about what they liked about the community and what they thought they could change, said Deb Harper, gifted coordinator for Decatur's public schools. The students presented their final projects on Tuesday at MacArthur High School. Once the topics were figured out, students broke into smaller groups to address each one and come up with some way to address it. Topics range from crime in Decatur to resisting peer group pressure to LGBT rights. When was the last time you looked at your phone, said Marie Schaefer, whose group was dubbed Techno. Was it a few minutes ago? Maybe you're looking at it right now. Young people and plenty of older ones are far too dependent on technology, the group decided, and they need to learn how to interact and socialize without constantly checking a news feed. The group's idea was to create an event for teens where no phones or tablets are allowed, with workshops on non-tech activities such as learning to cook, play the guitar, or paint with watercolors. Their hope is for students to develop new hobbies and interests and make new friends. We picked our topic because a lot of people think Decatur is just really a bad city, said Michaela Olivas, 12, whose group Positive Decatur has started Facebook and Twitter accounts dedicated to spreading positive messages. We want to point out the good things and make everybody realize it's not a bad place. It's just your bad outlook on it. Delaney Swanee's group devoted themselves to make LGBT people feel loved. A lot of our people in our group are LGBT or questioning. We wanted to work on it because we know it's an issue, especially where we live, and people overlook it a lot and don't realize what a big problem it is. In the presentation, Delaney, a Johns Hill Magnet School student, said she knew it was a sore subject, but that's why the group wanted to tackle it. Kids are facing these issues at younger ages now because of the internet, she said. It's very easy to discover yourself in this day and age and be more open with who you are. End of the article. End of part one for May 11th, 2016. Decatur, Herald and Review. Debbie signing off. Be back shortly.